Ain't got no money for an attorney, so I'm just another number of this industry. The war on drugs is a war on the poor. We got more prisons than we got Walmart stores. They're building prisons in the mountains to raise the economy, creating jobs out of slavery, creating jobs out of slavery. We got more black men in prison now than in university, and it's costing more to keep them there than a college degree. And there's millions of babies with a parent locked up, and there's no one at home to help them grow up. 'Cause if you ain't got the capital, you get the punishment. It feels like the real criminals are running this government. Tell me, who's the victim? Is it you? Tell me, who's the offender? Is it me? We are all responsible for our society.
This past weekend, thousands of prison abolitionists gathered in Oakland, California, for the Critical Resistance 10 conference. Among the speakers featured at the conference were members of the San Francisco 8, former Black Panthers who are being charged in a 37-year-old murder case. The San Francisco 8 allege that they're being framed by the current administration in a test case for the administration to see if confessions based on torture will be allowed in court now that, quote, harsh interrogation techniques have been approved by the president. There's no physical evidence linking the 8 men to the crime, and the only evidence linking them to the crime are confessions made during torture. The case was thrown out of court in 1973 due to the fact that torture was used to extract the confession. Now, 37 years later, the 8 men, all of whom are Black community activists, are facing charges. They were arrested on January 23rd of this year in California, New York, and Florida on charges related to the 1971 killing of a San Francisco police officer. Richard Brown, Richard O'Neill, Ray Boudreau, Hank Jones were all arrested in California. Francisco Torres was arrested in Queens, New York. Harold Taylor was arrested in Florida. Two men charged, Herman Bell and Jaleel Muntakim, have been held as political prisoners for over 30 years in New York state prisons. A ninth man, Ronald Stanley Bridgeforth, is still being sought. The men were charged with the murder of Sergeant John Young and conspiracy that encompasses numerous acts between 1968 and 1973. Harold Taylor and John Bowman are both recently deceased, as well as Reuben Scott, thought to be a government witness. Those three were first charged in 1975, but a judge tossed out the charges, finding that Taylor and his two co-defendants made statements after police in New Orleans tortured them for several days, employing electric shock, cattle prods, beatings, sensory deprivation, plastic bags, and hot, wet blankets for asphyxiation. Such evidence is neither credible nor legal. Now we'll hear from three of the defendants in the San Francisco 8 case that spoke this past weekend at the Oakland conference.
So we're going to introduce ourselves. I'm Sophia Elijah. To my right is
Hank Jones.
And I'm Richard Brown.
Harold Taylor.
Each of us is going to tell you a little bit about how we come to be sitting here talking about the San Francisco 8. And then we'll talk a little bit about the case. Then we'll open it up for Q&A. And in about 5 to 5, we'll stop and then play the DVD called Legacy of Torture. Okay? Does that work for everybody? So you know, it's okay, play. And before I go any further, I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge a couple of people in the room. One is Claude Marx over here to my far left, who I'll start with Harold Taylor. Tell us what was going on January 7, 2007.
Okay, as I said, my name is Harold Taylor. I'm 59 years old, soon to be 60. On January the 23rd of 2007, FBI, local police department, maybe 15, 20 officers came to my house, surrounded my house about 8 o'clock in the morning in a well-organized, coordinated raid to pick up everybody that's a part of San Francisco 8, the six of us. And I got a wife, two kids at home, petrified my kids, scared my wife to death. And they drug me from there to a little holding cell up in the woods in Florida, where they kept me in solitary confinement until I was extradited, because I refused to waive extradition because I wasn't going to help my opponents or my enemies. So I'm here today from the support of the committee and the support of the people that reached out and touched for us and got us out on bail and give us the opportunity to come talk to you guys. My name is Richard Brown. I'm from it's San Francisco, actually. I've been started out a Panther there in San Francisco. I'm here today mainly because of the power of the people, the support and the love that we got from everybody from coast to coast that put enough pressure on the powers that be so that the bail could be lowered from a ridiculous amount of $5 million all the way down to something that we were able to reach and because of the support of the people, community people who step forward and put up their property. We are here, and I'm able to come to you today and say thank you and all power to the people. On January the 23rd, I was at home. I'm a single parent. I have a son who was 18. He turned 18 a couple of weeks ago, and an adopted daughter, a six-year-old daughter, and which didn't mean anything to the people who came. And at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and arrested me on a trumped up charge that's almost 40 years old, and that was illegally done from the beginning. It even started because of torture. They took me to a jail, told me that I would never see my family again, that my bail was $5 million. I had at the time all kind of medical problems with my eyes, with my breathing, with my high blood pressure and a number of other things, which they knew about and commented on. And all these things in order to put pressure on me to get me to try to cooperate with them, which obviously they didn't read my jacket or record or whatever, because myself and none of the other eight, SF8, have ever actually cooperated with them in any way, shape, form, or fashion, and we actually never will. I was taken to jail. The people came and forced them to release me because of the fact that we have a decent judge who seems to want to go by the book and not, he wasn't influenced by the 40 or 50 police officers in court to keep him from lowering the bail. He lowered it anyway. So I want to thank all of you very much for coming and continue to support us.
My name is Hank Jones, and I'm 73 years old. I was working in as a real estate appraiser in Pasadena. And on January 7th, I got a call from phone rang, and it kept ringing and ringing. It was like 6 o'clock in the morning, and I tried to ignore it, but it wouldn't stop. And then I realized that it was my fax phone. I go answer the phone, and the sheriff and other law enforcement agents is on the line telling me to come out, keep the phone in my hand, and come out with my hands up. So I'm in my pajamas and some flip-flops, and they have me turn around and back up, and they put the cuffs on me and took me to the local sheriff's station. And we were arrested, and of course we were held for 8 months based on some, what they indicated was some new evidence, which of course never materialized. and hasn't to this day, and never will. So this traumatized, of course, my wife. This was the second time, a major trauma she'd been through. She had no knowledge of any of this stuff. The first visit from Erlatz to my home in 2003 to interview me. After I terminated the interview, they left my home and went directly to her job to try to intimidate her and put pressure on me, of course. Well, of course, that didn't work. We were arrested then for contempt of a grand jury. This is the fourth. We've been arrested multiple times. It's the fourth time in my life I've been arrested and served some time, all in, you know, a struggle for liberation. And arresting me will never change that. Killing me won't change that. This is something that can't be stopped, and this is something, for some reason, they can't seem to understand. They can't stop it because they didn't start. So, you know, this brings us up to this point in time. And what we're doing is trying to broaden our base, and that's our primary purpose, broaden the base beyond ourselves. We come together and we do this. This is beautiful. And what really inspires me is when we go to these college campuses and introduce this information to people who don't know, and like young people who showed up at the event last night. That was, you know, that is very uplifting. I was sitting next to a kid, looked like he was about 13 to 14, a young man, 13, 14 years old. And he was, you know, focused entirely on what was going on. That's what this is about. We have to broaden the struggle. Put aside, you know, the barriers that we create amongst ourselves. And, you know, recognize that this is a critical point, like a crossroad, you know, turning point in the history of this country. I've seen this once before, like in the movement of the 60s and 70s, when the people were in the streets. And there was a point in time when this government had a clear choice of submitting to the will of the people or taking a turn, a very hard turn to the right. And they chose to take the very hard turn to the right. That's when the assassination started, you know, and the COINTELPRO, you know, was enacted. So that's what why we're here today. This is a result of that hard right turn and that COINTELPRO reaction. And this is what we're combating, San Francisco 8.
One of the things that the Black Panther Party is responsible for, and that it did, particularly to me, is it taught me to be a servant of the people. I already felt in my heart I had love for the people, but it showed me that through unity that we could do something. We could make a difference in our community, and we could serve our people. And that the highest thing that a person, individual, could achieve was to be a servant of the people. Because of the counterintelligence program, they effectively destroyed the party as it was, but it didn't destroy how those of us who had been trained by the party felt and how we functioned and how we operated. I continued to be a servant of the people long after the Black Panther Party, so-called, was destroyed. I was able to analyze, sit down, and start working for community-based organizations because I felt that that was the best way for me to be able to ascertain or to determine what the needs of the people were, and then to go about some type of way of dealing with those needs. Working as a in community-based organizations, I was able to work in housing over the years. I even formed my own housing association so that we were able to keep people, poor people and minorities and our mothers with the single parents in the community in the Fillmore District there in San Francisco. We forced the redevelopment agency to adhere to its policy that residents who had been displaced were allowed the first opportunity to come back in. And this was a struggle. It was a fight. We had to really fight for it. But over the years, I was through working with the community and with people in it and the organizations that we started, we were successful in keeping a lot of black families and a lot of original residents of the Fillmore District in San Francisco. I worked with the school district in trying to do something with the education programs. I particularly got tired of seeing young kids of color, or Hispanics, blacks, and all others, being expelled from school in the second and third grade, or you know, being not suspended, expelled, told that you can't ever come back to school again, which is not only ridiculous and criminal, I mean, it's absurd. So we formed a task force in order to be able to deal with that type of thing in San Francisco, put pressure on the school board, and would just actually go to the schools and deal with the principals and whoever else was there in order to ensure that they wouldn't be able to do this to our children. I dealt with also jobs in the community through the, you know how they come in and they tear down your program, your community, and they take it and they make all kind of promises about what they're going to do for you, and you 50% of the job go to people who lived in that community. They didn't expect us to really fight for that, but we did, and we were able to make a difference. And that was why still a number of black people left in the Fillmore District, is because we were able to get them jobs. They were able to work, so therefore they were able to stay. I also dealt with the criminal justice system. I am a community court judge, which we have court at the place where I work at least once a month and sometimes twice a month. And the thing that I really got inspired about that and really that convinced me to do it is that in the community court, you don't go to jail. If we try to pull all the people to the community court as possible, particularly those young people who were first-time offenders, so that they wouldn't get a record started. If you come to community court, I mean, I'm actually a judge and work with the district attorney's office and the police department and everything else. Whenever they have people who were arrested in Fillmore District, they bring them to the community court, and I hear the so-called evidence or whatever their charges are, and 99% of the people are found not guilty. But those that are found guilty, what happens is that they are referred, and a lot of times when dealing with young people, I would give them a sentence of coming and doing community services at Ella Hill Hut so that I would be able to work with them and to deal with whatever problems that they had. Most people were in trouble because of a problem, because they didn't have a job, because they weren't educated, because they didn't have a support system, because of a number of reasons. And whatever those reasons were, I would try to work with them and see to it that we eliminated those leads so that we could keep people out of jail. If the person who came to community court, even if they were found guilty, if they were not arrested for the same charge within 12 calendar months, then that charge was dropped and they couldn't be used. It was as though they never had a charge, so it didn't show up on their record. So that was something I was able to do in order to keep them from just rounding up everybody once they turned 18 and giving them a criminal of record and getting them started and on their way to the penitentiary. This is still going on. I'm still a community court judge, and I'm still going to do everything I can to keep people out of jail and out of prison. But this is some of the things that I was doing when they came and got me. It's what I've been doing for the last 30 years, even after the Black Panther Party, and it's what I'll continue to do for the rest of my life, serve the people. What I basically do in my community is I try to mentor to young black men on the disadvantages of getting caught up in the system and becoming a statistic. I do a lot of work as far as like churches in my community. I live in Florida in a very small town. And in many ways, it's a very racist town. But I had to move to Florida because I couldn't keep a job in California. Every job I had in Los Angeles, the FBI came and said I was a terrorist, that I was a communist, that I was this, I was that, and I was this. So, you know, I decided, my mother decided for me. She asked me to leave the state because she was tired of me calling her house. So I moved to Florida, and I've been there since 1980. I spent a lot of time with kids in my community. I talked to kids about gangs. I talked to them about deception and how a police department and also the government has designed things the way that they are and created the conditions that created these squabbles amongst young men. And how dangerous it is for them once they get into the system and what happens to them once they get into prison. And it, like it's a vicious circle and a vicious merry-go-round. Once you get on, it's hard to jump off. So I spend a lot of time doing that, and I talk a lot about political prisoners. And I try to educate people about COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO is such a ruthless organization. It's the cause of the death of many black leaders, many aggressive, progressive people, like Leonard Peltier. It's a cause, that's COINTELPRO. You know, you see like Geronimo Pratt, that was COINTELPRO. You see people that's been assassinated, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King. All these people were set up by the FBI at one time or another. You have people like Marcus Garvey that was ran out of the country because of COINTELPRO. You have Paul Robeson, who was blackballed because of COINTELPRO. This reaches far, far back. There's a direct history that links all this together today. Today you have COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO is an extension of the Patriot Act. It's both the same. They both serve the same purpose. It's a divide and to make people fearless, make you scared, to make you fearful, make you dare to struggle. It makes you don't want to get involved in things because of the fear and the threat of going to prison or being executed. I learned COINTELPRO in a very ruthless way in 1971, myself and John Bowman, who was one of the starters of All of Us and None of Us. Me and John Bowman and another brother named Ray Boudreau was in a car in Los Angeles, the police, and the FBI set us up and ambushed us. They shot in that car over 280 times. We weren't supposed to live. We all lived. And the reason why I tell you that is because it did reinforce my purpose of being fearless and continue to struggle. To do that to me, they'll do that to you. And what they're doing with the San Francisco 8 is to discourage you young people from coming forward, to let you know that if you come forward, they will come after you the rest of your lives. But you gotta be fearless and you gotta have that dedication to your people and to the community and for the people at large. That's my experience with COINTELPRO, and it's a continuing thing, and it's gonna go on probably for the rest of my life, but I welcome that. I relish that because it gives me an opportunity to say a lot of things to young people. So, thank you.
I just want to echo one of the things that Harold was saying about the effort to try to frighten people and to convince you not to get involved. Claude and myself, we've done a lot of work in support of the San Francisco 8. Claude from the, both of us, just I can't even describe all the work that we've been doing. But one of the things that kind of brings this point home is, I guess it was around last spring, the government started turning over hundreds of thousands of pages of discovery material to the defense team. And buried in that material, or maybe not quite so buried, were emails that Claude had sent and that I had received about doing organizing work around these brothers, okay? Now, it's kind of hard to understand how those emails have anything to do with whether or not the charges of murder and conspiracy to commit murder some 37 years ago are or are not true, right? But what was the reason that they really shared those emails? It was to intimidate us and let us know that Big Brother, or Big MF'er, is watching, all right?
Yeah.
And that we shouldn't be involved. So what did that do? You know how frightened Claude and I got? We rolled up our sleeves and said, oh, we'll work just that much harder.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what we want you to do. think is next.
I just want to say something about, you know, this is a, we say this is a San Francisco 8. Actually, it was a San Francisco 9 because we lost our brother, John Bowman, in the end of 2006. The brother transitioned. And I've always felt that it was as a result of the torture that he endured in New Orleans 1973 that forced him to do things that he would not have ordinarily have done and say things he would not have ordinarily said if he'd had a choice. And he couldn't live with that. I know the brother, he didn't sleep. You know, I never saw him get into bed and go to sleep. He always took little naps and stuff, but he was always working, you know, and he was driven, I think, well, I know he was driven because I've known him that long. He's always been driven. But even more so after what happened to him in 1973. So it's we still have the brother with us wherever we go. His spirit is still with us. I know wherever he is, he's assigning tasks to somebody, you know. And he's always assigning tasks to us. He drives us still. So. Then we also have Herman Bell and Jaleel Muthakim and that are still locked up. We're trying to get those brothers transferred. We're trying to get the conspiracy charges dropped against them. That's you know, still ongoing, and we need your support to help us make this happen. Just like you helped us get out on bail, you. I heard RB say the bail was $5,000. Well, they initially wanted a $10 million bail, not $5 million. They wanted a $10 million. And I think that was even ridiculous to them. So they backed off and dropped it to $5 million apiece. And then, you know, it was reduced further by the judge, who obviously felt that the case didn't merit that kind of a stiff bail. And he made it well, not necessarily reasonable, but something that was within our ability to attain. So that's why we're sitting here today, because of your efforts, the efforts of the support committee and everybody that heard about this case and came out to support. That's the only reason we're sitting here today. And we want to, you know, thank everybody for that, first of all. And we want to also state that the brothers that are still in there, Herman and Jaleel, 37 years, you know, that we need to get those brothers out, and all political prisoners. This political prisoner. I've always said that this government tries to lock up its fallacies. You know, it can't face. This is kind of government that can't face its own flaws and inadequacy. It hasn't grown. It's a young nation. It hasn't grown up. It doesn't play well with others. You know, yet. It hasn't grown up enough to face its faults and admit them. So. They try to hide it by the truth, by locking up the brothers. You know, they don't even acknowledge, of course, you know this, they don't acknowledge political prisoners. Women are men, right. So we must make them face the fact. And we must educate the general public about this. We spend a lot of time talking with each other about this and strategizing and, you know, having these get-togethers and what have you. Black Panther Party was created in a similar environment. And, you know, I was a community activist. I saw this thing develop. These brothers got tired of talking and started going into, they first they put together a 10-point platform program. Then they put together a survival program. Then they went out and they instituted the program. And they were willing to face whatever consequence arose from that. So this is what we have to do. In my community, we're trying to put together a youth organization that is going to train some activists, critical thinkers, analytical thinkers, that will address the problems confronting our community. Because if we don't, it'll be just like the Fillmore. It won't exist anymore. They'll gentrify the thing. We've already lost 2,400 black families since the 2000 census. So we have to get out in front of this, on top of this thing now. We can't wait for that. That's something that the youth can do. They will devise, first of all, they'll create, imagine these programs, create them, and then they will institute them to serve the community, just like the Black Panther Party did.
I'm going to do a little commercial. For those of you who came in late, there's a letter going around calling for the dropping of the charges against the San Francisco 8. I'm hoping that it's still moving around so that everybody gets to sign it. Okay? We're going to pass the mic to Richard Brown, to my left. And we've got about 10 more minutes, and then we're going to show the film.
Try it.
A lot of people say, that it's ridiculous that they would come up with this case after 37, almost 40 years. It's 38 or 39 now. But I tried to get them to understand that it is, if you look at it in that sense, it's kind of ridiculous. But they had a brand, all of this fits into this still overall thing that they've been doing in this country ever since the advent of the Patriot Act and Homeland Security. And once we got that that idiot in the White House who just ramrods everything through and calls itself the decider, regardless of what the people want. This government does not belong to the people anymore. It belongs to corporate America. What they did when they came and got us, number one, they felt that it was a slam dunk case because they were depending heavily on racism because you got eight black men who were labeled Panthers, which they labeled as gangsters and terrorists and thugs, and that, all through the years we've been labeled everything other than what we are, freedom fighters and servants of the people. But because of the fact that they felt that they had done enough propaganda against us, they felt that racism would kick in. They thought also that they had, they were hoping that they would have some old, tired people who were frightened and weak and about ready to give up and give in and could be frightened into doing anything that they just most some scared people, and we are not scared people, so that went against them. They were hoping that the community wouldn't come out and support because they threw that label out there, cop killer, cop killer, cop killer, which normally makes people back off and make people apprehensive about even coming to support. It didn't work with them. They also didn't count on the fact that we overnight somehow managed to put together the baddest legal team in the world, and so these people got immediately off into their behind. The community came immediately to our support. We immediately told them to go stuff it because we were not scared people, and everything fell apart on them. They wanted to be able to use this case in order to bring forth, which they're still trying to do, confessions that were obtained through torture way back in 1973. That if you remember at the time, you had Bush and Cheney running around talking about, well, torture's all right, we want to push it through, and they wanted to test the American people. They also wanted to test the courts. He had packed the Supreme Court. He have all those idiots up there that'll do whatever he says. So he felt that even if we got it to the Supreme Court and say, is it all right for us to use the confession that was obtained through torture, they would say, sure, go right ahead. All of this they were hoping to do. All of this blew up in their face. So now they come up with this thing about new evidence and 300 witnesses. They do have 300 people that they could call. Half of them are deceased, and the other half are family members and stuff who will only testify in our behalf. They did, from what I understand, they come up with some new DNA.
That's exonerate.
That doesn't match anybody, but it is. It's new, so I guess you
can. It's new for us.
Yeah. But they were actually planning on using this case to test the American people, to test the will of the American people, to see how far they could get away with torture, and to ram it down the people's throat. And to prove again to young people that, you know, you better not ever think about challenging us, because we will come after you no matter what. Now, don't please, young people, look at that lesson, look at that and learn from it. I want you to learn that if you don't ever give up, they can't ever win. Just keep struggling, keep fighting, do what's right. And you're going to have to... The example from us is to continue to struggle, continue to fight, to continue to serve the people. And I know we're going to be victorious. We're going to be able to bring home, we're going to free them all. Thank you.
Free them all.
You are listening to the former Black Panthers known as the San Francisco Eight. Richard Brown, or RB, a community organizer, was just speaking. We heard from Hank Jones and Harold Taylor speaking this last weekend in California at the Critical Resistance 10 conference, a prison abolitionist conference. And these men are Black Panthers who are being framed by the current administration in what they allege is a test case for the administration to see if confessions based on torture will be allowed in court. They have been charged with a 1971 murder of a police officer, and the only evidence linking them to the crime are confessions made under torture.